Today's teisho will be on case 62 in the Hekigan Roku in the Piyendu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 62 is entitled Umon's One Treasure. Engo's introduction. With untaught wisdom, he engages in the subtle action of inaction. With unsolicited compassion, he becomes your true friend. With a single word, he kills you and saves you. In one move, he lets you go and holds fast. Tell me, who is it that comes in this way? See the following. Main subject. Umon said to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there is one treasure. It is hidden in the mountain form. You take the lantern, entering the Buddha hall, and you can take the temple gate, placing it above the lantern. Setcho's verse, look on the ancient bank. Who is that holding the fishing rod? Quietly moving clouds, boundless waters, the bright moon, the white flowers of the reeds. See, you see by yourself. Here it is, summer. We've gone through many months, many cold months, and there's a cold winter here in New Jersey. Four months ago, we were here sitting. Snow was falling on several occasions. It was quite cold, you know. Days were short. Get up and it's dark until around 7. 4:30, 5 o'clock, dark. Now, here's summer. We get up and it's already starting to turn light. And it's light until 7:30, 8 o'clock. Birds singing madly in the trees, beautiful. We sit in the winter, we sit in the summer. I think it's a beautiful way to live. And I'm so happy you all could be here today. I mentioned last night that I've been reading this wonderful collection of translations from the Pali Sutras. This is a collection of the teachings of the Buddha in one particular dialect from the Indian subcontinent. There were other collections. There was apparently a Sanskrit collection. But in around the 11th and 12th centuries, foreign invasions destroyed all the big centers of Buddhist learning in India. All the other collections were destroyed. So, fortunately, one collection survives, the Pali Sutras. And these were not all written down at the same time, but they're probably pretty reliable. The Buddha did not write down his teachings. He delivered them orally. And he talked to all different kinds of people and taught his way. And after he died, his followers got together and tried to preserve his teachings orally as a speech. Different people in the Sangha committed themselves to remembering different sutras. These were different times when the Buddha had offered teaching, often to somebody in particular. So the early sutras often have the form of, they often have the title of the person the Buddha was addressing. And so the Buddha might have met a certain person who asked him some questions, and the Buddha responded, sometimes in detail. And the monks who lived after the Buddha tried to remember the conversation. Different people would remember different conversations, what the Buddha said and what the particulars were. And these people, for about 200 years, maybe a little bit more than that, preserved the Buddha's teachings as just by memory. And so they have many elements of an oral tradition. So there's a lot of repetition, and then there's the introduction of some new elements. But they were written down later, and in Pali, which was a language very close to what the Buddha actually spoke. And the Pali collection has survived today. And the interesting thing is that if you read them, even though they were delivered at different times to different people, there's remarkable consistency. So on one day the Buddha gives a talk about meditation practice, and at another time, maybe many years later, he'll talk about meditation practice, and there's remarkable consistency in the two teachings. So probably some of this is quite reliable, you know. It's really interesting to read, because I have read some of the Pali Sutras, the early teachings of the Buddha. Of course, I spent my life practicing Zen Buddhism. And the Buddha didn't teach people to use koans, you know. Reading this, though, is quite striking how similar what we're doing is to actually what the Buddha taught people to do. I thought it was really, it's just very interesting. One of the things the Buddha says is that, he says that it's difficult to wake up in ordinary life, you know? It's difficult. And he says, you know, life at home, he says, life in your house, if you live in a house, life in your house is crowded and noisy and dirty, you know? Now, I don't know how the Buddha knew that my house was dirty. But much has changed, right, in 2,500 years. When I was growing up, the house I grew up in was like a madhouse a lot of the time, you know. Everybody was coming in and going out, and it was very difficult to have any thoughts, you know, because everybody was running around like crazy. People might be arguing. Somebody's in the living room watching television. In another room, somebody's, entertaining friends. There's a bicycle lying down in the driveway, so Dad can't get in the driveway. You know, somebody's spilled something in the refrigerator, and it doesn't smell good. And you know, one of the lessons you learn, if you want to be good at school, is that you have to, is that the life in the house is noisy and crowded. And that if you want to get anywhere in school, you have to find a place in the house, or maybe not in the house, where you can close the door and be by yourself. And you can actually concentrate. Yeah? And that's actually, that's very difficult in your house. So I think, with, you know, things haven't changed that much. It's very difficult living an ordinary life to wake up, because you're surrounded by other people, and they all have their preoccupations, and they're all making demands on your time, and they're upset about something, or they're elated about something, and they want to communicate it to you, or they want you to sign their petition, or. And of course, as you know, surviving is very time consuming, right? You know, if you have a job, you have to work many, many hours a day just to pay the bills. And so you're so busy trying to survive and interacting with other people and so on and so on. It's very difficult to wake up. And so in the Buddha's time, as in our time, you've got to sort of separate yourself. It's just absolutely crucial. You have to if you want to be a student, you have to close the door, and you have to, you know, get away from the TV and all the other goings on in the house, and then you find a quiet place where you can sit down and concentrate. And you can study your math, or you can study your history book. And this is like the beginning of having like mental control. Right, control over your mind, control over your life, and learning how to be like a student is a form of that, you know. And you have to sort of like break out of the house. And people actually leave the house and they go to school because you can learn better if you're not in the house with the TV and all the comings and goings and so on. And now, you know, sesshin is like that too. You know, the ordinary lifestyle of the average human being is not dedicated to waking up. It wasn't in the Buddha's time, and it's not in our time. And in the Buddha's time, people had to pretty much get away from the house. And they became wandering monks or nuns, or they lived in like a monastery or convent, and they devoted themselves to meditation practice, so that just concentration, consciously taking charge of your life. And this is what we do at sesshin. You know, even though our culture, you know, it's interesting, in the 2500 years since the Buddha, we have great material prosperity and technological sophistication. But the ordinary life of the ordinary person is pretty much just as confused as ever, in my opinion. In fact, maybe it's even more confused, although people have been, you know, the ordinary life is not about waking up, it's about surviving, it's about, you know, millions of people have no interest in waking up. They want to be rich, they want to be famous, they want to be happy. They want to be safe. They don't necessarily want enough. They want a little bit more than enough. There's a fairly large number of people in the world who would take the bread out of your own mouth to be happy. That's the truth. And there are, of course, people of great kindness too, fortunately, and great compassion too. And some of those people don't practice meditation at all. But, you know, you leave the house and you go into your room if you want to be a student, and if you want to practice Zen, you might have to leave the house a certain number of times a year or a certain number of times a week. A woman, Mary is her name, she's been practicing with our group for, I guess, a couple of months, I think that's right. And she's very enthusiastic about Zen practice. And I said, "Are you practicing at home?" And she said, "I just can't." She said, "I have two little kids. I have a job, and I have all of these household concerns." But she said, "It's not just that. I just don't have the self-discipline to do. She said, "I don't know what it is, but it's so hard for me to sit on my own." And so she comes to the sit in the evening, at least once a week, and sometimes she's been there all three times, but maybe twice at least. And she's so happy. This helps her so much. There's something about Sangha. You know, this is like a place where people can go to cultivate awakening. It could be a room at the university, or it could be here at Sesshin for deeper experience. We've all left our homes, and we've all closed the door, and we're here now to practice our path. So even though we have a house, I have a house, even though I pay bills and so on and have a job, you know, for this week I'm a home leaver. I'm left my home, and I'm anagarika, having no home, just like a monk, or just like a nun. And this condition of closing the door and leaving home behind is really very important if you want to wake up. Now, it was interesting to me also that just the book was such an eye-opener. As he was talking about how difficult it is to wake up in the world, because the world is such a crazy place, I just thought, gosh, this is just like today. Now maybe things are actually crazier, although I think things were pretty crazy in the Buddha's time too. It was interesting to see many of the details of what he taught, and also just the general spirit. You know, at one place in the collection, somebody asked the Buddha about somebody came up to him and said, "You are the Buddha, and you are the leader of this community called the Sangha." And he said, "Are you the only one who has had who has woken up, who has had an enlightenment experience?" The person sort of said, "Are you like a uniquely enlightened person? Are you one and only a person who has achieved this knowledge or this experience, I should say?" And the Buddha said, "No, actually not." And it's a beautiful passage because he says. I'm not the only one who has had awakening experience, has had that kensho. And he said, in fact, not one monk, not 100 monks, but hundreds of monks have had that kensho in the Sangha. And then the person says, "Well, what about the nuns?" And the Buddha says, "Not one nun, not 100 nuns, but hundreds of nuns have awakened, have had daikensho in the Sangha." And then the person says, "Well, what about laymen who follow your path?" And the Buddha says, "Not one layman, not 100 laymen, but hundreds of laymen have achieved enlightenment. Had daikensho." And he says, and then of course the person says, "And what about lay women?" And the Buddha says, "Not one lay woman, not 100 lay women, but hundreds of lay women have had daikensho." And then he goes through and then the person says, "Well, what about people who haven't had daikensho yet?" And the Buddha said, "Well, you know," and the Buddha explains that there's people who haven't yet had daikensho, but whose lives have been made so much better by practicing this path. And they're free from, and they're not tortured by anxiety, and so on and so on. There's different levels of attainment along the path. And he starts with people who have had a daikensho. He starts with people who have purified body, mind, and heart to a very advanced degree, and who live a very different kind of consciousness. He talks about people who are just beginning on the path, and he looks at different, so he lays out the whole path, and it's really something I think anybody who practices can recognize. I just thought it was wonderful that he, I mean, among other things, I thought it was wonderful that he made no distinction between, they ask about men who have had enlightenment. He says there are men who have had complete enlightenment. They ask about women who have had complete enlightenment. Yes, there's hundreds of women who have had complete enlightenment, many hundreds. So I thought that was interesting. It was interesting too. I had not read this particular sutra before, but in another sutra, somebody asked the Buddha about caste, and the Buddha very specifically rejects caste, and he says that a true noble person is not born that way. That man or woman creates a noble mind, body, and heart through effort and through self-cultivation. At that time, there were four castes in India. And the Buddha, first of all, rejects the idea of caste. And then he goes on to say that anybody from any caste can achieve Daikensho, Great Awakening. So I thought that was interesting. Something else I thought was interesting was the path that the Buddha lays out. And see if I can find it. When the Buddha talks about mental cultivation, he has divides it up into stages or stages, and it goes something like this. Let me see if I can find it. Well, first of all, he says there are people who are in the world who are deeply confused and unhappy. And he calls those people uninstructed worldlings. I thought that was a great. And he says when the uninstructed worldling experiences a painful feeling, he sorrows, he grieves, he laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. He feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. Suppose they were to strike a man with a dart and then strike him immediately with a second dart, so that the man would feel a feeling caused by two darts. So too, when the uninstructed worldling experiences a painful feeling, he feels two feelings. Is it mental agitation and physical agitation? I think that's when I was in intermediate school, I didn't know how to study for algebra, and I began to become obsessed with my inability to pass tests in algebra, and I would get so nervous I would almost throw up, you know. And when I would get an F, I would be physically sick. My stomach would feel like throwing up. You know? So I think something to that. So anyway, if you don't want to be an uninstructed worldling, you could try doing some zazen. And there's different stages to the path. And the Buddha calls those jhanas, J-H-A-N-A-S, jhanas. And there's four jhanas. When you start meditating, when you start doing meditation practice, the first jhana comes from simply sitting on the cushion and closing the door and contemplating. So So some people read a book about Zen and they decide to come to sit on a Tuesday, on a Monday or a Friday night, and they sit down on the cushion and they just start watching their mind. They're watching the breath, they become aware of their thoughts. And actually, this is tremendously, for some people, this is meaningless, and it doesn't, and they don't come back. But for some people, this is very liberating in itself. In other words, instead of being uninstructed worldling, pulled this way and that way by our emotions and our fears and our conditioning, our cultural conditioning, We sit down on the cushion in a quiet place, we quiet our mind, and we realize what's happening to us. Yeah? We just realize, my gosh, you know, look at how nervous I am, look at how angry I am. How did I get so angry? This is like contemplation. And the Buddha said if you sit down on a cushion and you just engage in this activity, you'll feel sooner or later like you've had a great, it's like a cool breeze on you. It's like you realize, oh my gosh, I can change my life. I can change my life. I don't have to be afraid all the time. I don't have to be angry all the time. You know, and so basically, you're looking at your life. You're contemplating your life. You see the anger. You see the fear. You see the whatever, possess enviousness, whatever. And you realize that you have to change your life, but when you make that resolution, you feel happier. And this is, some people get off the cushion on a Monday night, and they're really very inspired by this practice because they've had a little taste of liberation. And they feel, a Buddha says, if you do this, you'll feel a kind of joy. And that's the first jhana, according to the Buddha. In the second jhana, you stop contemplating. You stop turning over your life like thoughts in your head. And your mind becomes very still, very quiet. Yeah? And you begin to notice there's a kind of stillness or quiet in your mind. And basically, this stillness leads to, like you could say, the third jhana, which is, I guess you could say, we begin to notice that you can focus your mind like a flashlight, you know? In Zen we call this one-pointedness of mind, and that actually goes all the way back to the origin of Buddhism. In other words, your mind, first you have contemplation, then you have this equanimity, this great calm. Then you develop like this laser-like concentration, yeah? At any rate, I have to say I've always had trouble keeping the jhanas straight. So even though let me see if I can find. At any rate, when you finish the four jhanas, your mind is stable, it's calm, it's focused, yeah. And then you begin, you stop paying attention stop being like obsessively concerned with your surroundings, you know. And everybody who does meditation has gone through the four jhanas. We don't talk about it in Zen, but I think we can all recognize these states. And then the Buddha says there's three more levels after going from first jhana up to second jhana to third jhana to fourth jhana. He says that after you are you have one-pointed mind and you're no longer caught up in your surroundings, you know, when you're beginning to be in deep samadhi, a body sensation is much less. Things around you don't absorb your attention. Thoughts don't absorb your attention. The Buddha says, you begin to have this sense of like spaciousness all around you. It's like he says, infinity of space. So when you begin to feel, once you've entered, we say, deep samadhi, and you're no longer caught up in thoughts, you're no longer emotionally responding to your fears and anxieties, you have one pointedness of mind and so on, you begin to experience like this spaciousness, which I think probably many of you have experienced on the cushion. And the Buddha calls it infinity of space. And then there's another stage, which is the Buddha calls like infinity of consciousness. It's like you realize that the limits, your awareness does not stop with your body, but it extends outward in all directions. And it becomes very difficult to say where you start and where you stop, you know. Now, again, I think we've all experienced that. You know, maybe this morning when you heard the birds, you know, at some point, ordinary consciousness makes a very sharp distinction between what's mine and what's not mine, but in very deep samadhi, everything happening around me is in some way connected to me, right? My mind doesn't stop with the barrier or the limits of my body. Everything out around me is experienced as like this part of this infinite mind. And then the Buddha said, there's one more level, which is, we all know what that is. It's called, he says, it's the base of nothingness. That's nothingness, or shunyata. This is early Buddhist teaching. And so after the four jhanas, and the three forms of concentration that go beyond the four jhanas, we end up in mūshin. Yeah? Now, in mūshin, this is not enlightenment, but we now have to direct our attention to seeing reality as it actually is. Yeah? And in this way, we gradually free ourselves from karmic obstructions, which the Buddha calls, in Pali, the Buddha calls karmic obstructions taints, like tainted cloth, like a stain on a cloth. And the Buddha actually says, you know, doing meditation is like washing your cloth. And he says, you might have a cloth that has stain, and you might take some ashes, some lye, some ashes and some tallow, and mix it with water, and then put the cloth in there and scrub it until it came out clear and clean. And that's what we're doing with our mind, yeah? It's fascinating. And so it's just like laundering a cloth, and we take out the taints. These are your deeply rooted psychological obstructions. And then finally, the cloth is clean, and we can see the cloth as it really is. You know, now what once we've gone through the jhanas and we've gone through the formless levels of awareness, we're in mūshin, and we begin to experience the world, observe the world, without karmic obstructions kicking in. And the Buddha said, if you do this long enough, you will have achieve liberation. So this is so similar to, I think, even though we have koans, and Buddha didn't teach people koans, this is really very much like what we're doing. You could think of koans as a way of observing, a special way of observing things as they really are. Yeah. So So after we've purified body, mind, and heart, we turn our attention to some aspect of the moment. And the koans are asking us to look at some aspect of the moment. And sooner or later, the boundary between ourselves and the world is going to disappear in a decisive way, and that is what people mean by daikensho, or awakening. And the Buddha said that in that state, he said it's not really describable in language, because language is too crude an instrument to do justice to it. But when he does describe enlightenment, he says, you know, what's missing from an enlightened mind is I am. So the sense of separated individuality, the I am, is gone. And life is lived in a very different way after that. So, you know, even though Zen is arises in China quite a long time after the Buddha, I think we can all appreciate how similar all of this is. I mean, again, as I say, we don't go through formal jhanas. Nobody says, have you finished the first jhana? Have you finished the second jhana? But in fact, you know, actually, when we sit down on the cushion, we do go through the jhana. And we do, maybe not always in this order, one through four, and then, but basically, all of this should be recognizable to us on the cushion. And it is a good way to start the sesshin to remind ourselves that people have been doing this for thousands of years, you know, and that there's something we're 21st century people, you know. The Buddha's life was long ago. But a very accurate account of reality, certainly an accurate account of the human mind. There's a man who just wrote a book called, some of you might know, there's a guy named Austin who wrote a book called Zen and the Brain. And he has done extensive studies of how Zen practice transforms your consciousness. And I just received his new book, and just before sesshin, I had to force myself to put it down because it was so interesting. And Mr. Austin has a new book called Selfless Insight. And he says, how is it possible for people to be aware without having a sense of self? And he gives you the brain science, you know, what it means to be outside the artificial construct we call the self. So if you're interested in that book, I'd be happy to share it with you. But his book is really just an explanation of what we do here on the cushion. You know, this morning we all sat together and we entered deep samadhi, one-pointed mind, deep samadhi. We reached the base of nothingness, and I hope in some cases. And then from the base of nothingness, you're either working to remain in that state, or you're turning from that state back to the world of form with your koan. And so not much has really changed, as it turns out. Engo's introduction. With untaught wisdom, he engages in the subtle action of inaction. With unsolicited compassion, he becomes your true friend. With a single word, he kills you and saves you. In one move, he lets you go and holds you fast. Tell me, who is it that comes in that way? Umang, Cloudgate, says to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there is one treasure. There's one treasure. It's hidden in the mountain form. You take the lantern entering the Buddha hall, and you take the temple gate, placing it above the lantern. What does that mean? What does that mean? Well, you know, there's a life lived in the self, in the I am, you know? And as we all know, or we wouldn't be here, there's something unsatisfactory about that life. It's fearful, anxious, envious, aggressive. If you have a small enough self, you really will take the bread out of another person's mouth to make yourself happy. People do it every day. And even if you try to be a good person, you know, there's something about the self which limits your compassion, in my opinion. So basically, we're here because we understand that there's something unsatisfying about being me, whoever me happens to be, and that there's a different way to live. Buddha said, you know, it's possible to be a selfless person. Now, he wasn't talking about self-sacrifice. You know, don't make that mistake. You know, when the Buddha was practicing enlightenment, he did not understand what it means to have a larger consciousness, and so he decided to stop eating and to sort of like whip himself into enlightenment. Yeah? And he got to the point where he almost starved to death and went through other terrible austerities. And then he realized, I'm not getting any closer to enlightenment, I'm just making myself miserable and I'm going to die. So anyway, he decided that he would, he was going to die if he didn't do something, so he decided to go get something to eat. And he had some rice and some milk. But he went through, after he began to eat, he was afraid that eating would defile him, or make him impure again. You know? And yet, then it occurred to him. He said, there is a pleasure or a joy which has nothing to do with selfishness at all. There's a joy at the heart of existence, which is not, it's not about me. And it's not, you know, there's some pleasures that make us small, that lock us back into the small self. So if I leave sashin, and I have a beer or something like that, I guess that's okay, but you're not really getting outside of your small self. You're not. You say, after sashin, I'm going to go have a beer, and I'm going to go to a movie and eat food that I couldn't eat at sashin, and so on and so on. This is like not liberation. But the Buddha said, you know, my path is not about self-mortification. It's not about being miserable and beating myself up. Why was I so afraid of this joy, this happiness, which is not defiling? It doesn't make your mind crude. It doesn't make your mind coarse. It has nothing to do with the self. So when we sit down on the cushion and we begin to concentrate on mu, and the mind empties out, self-consciousness disappears, and then there should be a real joy that arises at that moment. If you haven't noticed it yet, please notice it. Real joy. So this path is not about like self-mortification. It's about a richer life, more beautiful life, and actually happier life. So, here we are together walking this beautiful path, Dharma friends. Yeah? And what a wonderful opportunity this is. I'm glad you're here, and now we're setting off on day one.